Well, first, I want to say they're not just a cultural phenom in the United States. It's worldwide. They have made a name for themselves all over the planet, really. I mean, people were cheering for them that don't like the United States about anything else. Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
Hello, I'm Matt Bush, the news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio. I also produce Going Deep along with the Shoups, and as you may have guessed from the short intro at the top, this episode will examine and celebrate the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, which won its second consecutive Women's World Cup title with a 2-0 victory over the Netherlands in the final on July 7, 2019. We begin our discussion with Marcia touching on why the team has become the cultural force it is in the U.S.
But I think there are several reasons, and one is the thing I don't want us to lose sight of in the you know, kind of amazing things that they have accomplished and who they are, but that women's sports has come so far just in my lifetime. I was born in 1969, and you know, Title IX came along in the early 70s, and you know, the way that women's sports has, you know, we've all worked hard as female athletes to give opportunities for the next generation. And here are the fruits of this, again, my generation's moving from complete nothing for women to, you know, this world stage where they have just dominated. So that's one thing. I feel like it's dues paid, it's history, it's hard for me to not get choked up just watching them. It's awesome. But the other thing I think that is amazing is, and that has made them such a cultural phenomenon, is not only do they, you know, have exciting play and amazing personalities, and they win, they back up their swagger with wins, but these women have a lot of moral courage. They're willing to speak into the most difficult issues that our country's facing, that the world is facing. They don't apologize for themselves, for their sexuality, for the fact that they're a cross-racial team. They are just them. They're themselves. And I think when people see that kind of confidence, some would call it arrogance, but I'll call it confidence, that kind of confidence that is also backed up by success, that's magnetic. People want to be around that. People want to listen to them. I also think they have they've not missed a step with criticism. They've gotten a lot of heat, including from the President of the United States, but they really haven't let that take a lot of their energy. So I'd say they're kind of this bright light that is burning so brightly because of all the generations, all the women, all the different stories that have fed into this moment in our history when women, you know, can be dominant in a sport that's a world stage kind of sport.
And there is a bit of a double standard when it comes to sort of the boastfulness and the arrogance and how they were called out for it, where with male athletes we would see, and John, having coached football, I'm sure you were around a lot of male athletes that were just as boastful, just as braggy. Mm-hmm. And it's treated very differently, right?
Oh, yeah. People don't like strong women. I can attest to that. I want us to remember some of the lineage, like Brandi Chastain making that clutch penalty shot in the 1999 World Cup to win in the Rose Bowl that was packed full of people, and she rips off her shirt just like men do when they win. And just think of all of the heat that she got for that. I mean, she was quoted in a New York Times article last week saying, I still get asked about that. You know, she was on a plane and somebody was like, are you going to take your shirt off? And she's like, not today. You know, I mean, how many men have to answer those questions? But the fact that women are on a world stage winning and not apologizing for their bodies, not, you know, kind of having to slow play it or be, you know, keep things under wraps, but just being who they are, being strong, is, I can't tell you what that means to me as a woman, and I know to other women as well.
And that's a person who absolutely loves athletics and sports. I can't tell you what it means to me to watch a team that is probably the best ever at what they do. So you can take all the personalities, all the swagger, all the politics, all that. Perhaps the most attractive thing to me is they're the best in the world at what they do. They are probably the best ever. And I think there's some real reasons for that. When you talk about soccer in the United States, specifically women's soccer in the United States, there may not be a group of people that benefited more from Title IX in 1972 than a generation of women who grew up playing soccer. Think about this for a second. 1972, Title IX prohibited educational institutions receiving federal funding from discriminating based on gender. Now, everybody knows the biggest part of Title IX, or maybe the most famous part of Title IX, has to do with equal athletic opportunities. Think about this for a second. In 1972, 700 girls were playing high school soccer throughout America. Today, 390,000 young women play soccer in high school across America. From 1972, when Title IX started, to the first Women's World Cup in 1991, there was a 17,000% increase in women playing soccer. And maybe the most important thing about Title IX was that it wasn't a law that was enacted that merely allowed women to play sports. It required schools that were receiving federal funding, it required them to create opportunities for women. And women's soccer seized so many of those opportunities at a time really when throughout the world even, women didn't have some of those same opportunities. And this makes it a unique American experience.
So there's some contours to Title IX that we need to raise up here that make this not just a story of a beautiful victory and a law really working. It is a law that has had an impact in a positive way in women's lives in many, many ways. But one of the reasons why women's soccer in particular has flourished with Title IX is because of football. Football is the
American football
in educational institutions in the United States. There are so many bodies on a football team. And if you're going to have equity, then you've somehow going to have to find some sports that have a lot of bodies for women. So I was a runner, you know, track, cross country. Those teams aren't ever going to have as many players on them as a football team, although I did have 80 runners on my cross-country team in West Lafayette, Indiana.
In junior high.
but But what I'm saying is, one of the reasons why a sport like soccer has flourished in Title IX is because schools wanted to nurture that size of a roster. It helped them create equity and still have a great football team. Because if you just have, you know, some of the more minor sports for women, like basketball, and that's not a minor sport, but track, cross country.
It'd be sports that have lower rosters.
You're not going to have as many people. So a sport like soccer was an ace in the hole for colleges especially. So those programs got developed.
And it's just to clarify for everybody, it's that, you know, you have to have this equal, it's an equal number of players.
Equal.
So if a football roster in the NCAA is 80 players,
yeah.
American football has 80 players, well then you have to balance out 80
That's
80
hard
women
to do.
Athletes, yes, and you're right. That is kind of
hard,
to do in individual sports, which are most, which are what most college
right.
sports are.
And that's why my college had, you know, we had women's field hockey. We had, you know, we had some other minor sports like that to round out those numbers because we had a healthy football team. So that's one thing that colleges weren't stupid. They saw that they needed to develop this particular size roster sport for women, and really soccer was one of the only ones that existed. So when I was a little girl, the first soccer league for kids came into being. I was in elementary school. I was the only girl on the team, on my team. A few other girls came out as the years went by, but once I got to high school, there was no girls' team. That was in the 80s. There was one girl that went to high school with me that played on the boys' team. They had to let her play on the boys' team. But the big sports in my school were cross-country and track, so that's where a lot of girls went. There wasn't anywhere for me to go with soccer. There was somewhere for me to go with running. Now the next generation after me, there are girls' teams in high schools. There are girls' teams in college. So there's somewhere to go with it. And again, you're seeing as the decades roll on, you're starting to see like girls get more and more motivated to stick with soccer. So underneath, again, all of this World Cup success is club teams for girls starting at age 3. Our daughter was on a club team that traveled when she was like 4 years old. And so there's this pipeline that starts really early for girls in travel soccer, and it is a major moneymaker. It's an industry, just like, you know, you see in some of the boys' sports and AAU and things like that. Girls' soccer is, and I think girls' softball is more and more like that, but girls' soccer has been so tied to this club system and these travel teams. And again, it's just kind of a way of life now for families with daughters. That's just kind of a rite of passage. You do that.
And it really kind of explains one thing I wanted to get to is just to why the women's soccer team in the United States, there is no really of any other of the major team sports, there's no American team that is as good or as dominant in its particular sport. And we actually talked about this but before we started recording. Of the four, let's say, major team sports that are played internationally, which again eliminates American football, but that would be soccer, hockey, basketball, and baseball, softball. There is no other American team, male or female, that is as strong as the women's soccer team is.
That's right.
The men's basketball
team
the Olympics is probably the one group that approaches it. And they've
but they
certainly
don't have a World Cup.
When all the great professional NBA players were playing in what they called the Dream Team with Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan.
Yeah,
I mean, certainly they could beat anybody, anytime, anywhere. But you're exactly right. There's something unique about this women's team and something uniquely American about this process of how women's soccer became so big. Listen, I used to be a football coach, and there was a period of time where I was one of those guys that actually thought, you know, Title IX is kind of going to ruin football. Title IX, everything should be equal, and we just take football out of the equation because women don't play football. I was actually one of those people that thought that. And there were a lot of people. In fact, there was an amendment proposed. I think it was called the Towers Amendment in the 80s. And Bo Schembechler, Tom Osborne, all the great college football coaches went to Washington to fight for this amendment that equality should exist on the campuses, but don't count the scholarship football players in that number because that makes it unfair for other men's sports, i.e. swimming might get cut, wrestling
might
get cut.
And that happened at a lot of big level schools, D1 schools, things like tennis and swimming and diving ended up getting cut.
Yes.
Because of football.
But it was because of football.
But
it was blamed on Title IX.
Right. So in football, it used to be that you could have an unlimited number of scholarships.
Right.
And then it, at some point, reduced to 105 and is now, in football, you're allowed 85 scholarships. So say a university has 150 male athletes on scholarship, then they need to have 150 female athletes on scholarship as well. And if 85 of those are taken up by American football for the men, well, that means some of those men's sports are going to disappear. And that's what happened. And I did feel like, son of a gun, that's not fair. And I'm going to tell you what changed it. One, marrying Marcia. And two, having a daughter. When you're in this all-male world and you don't talk to anybody else outside of your world, of course you start to think that. And I grew up with only brothers. My mom didn't play any sports at all. And so that's the way that I viewed the world. And when I became proximate to women that were athletic, Marcia, other friends in college, and then when I had a daughter, I thought to myself, yeah, I think they deserve those same opportunities. And it's a very narrow-sighted view if you think football should just be left out of that. And in my opinion, this Title IX, I don't know if I can name a law that has worked as well in some regards to accomplishing what its goal was, at least in terms of athletics. We are the best women's soccer team in the world has ever seen, and women's sports have blossomed amazingly in our lifetime. And that's because of Title IX, a big part.
Thing I would say that makes this team iconic is the way they lift the veil on some of the, you know, the kind of biggest, I'm just going to go on and say it, lies of patriarchy. You know, one of the things that women's soccer has helped us to see is just strong women who can play the sport. They can back up their bravado with their play, but also the question of equal pay that they have provoked and that they have, you know, taken into the courts. There's this circularity to the argument around football and Title IX and pay inequity, which, by the way, is not just in women's soccer. It's in everything. Women, on average, make less than men for doing the same job. But one of the things the women's soccer team is doing to lift the veil on some of these patriarchal concepts that are so deeply formative for us, we can't even see around them, is to show the circularity of it. Like, well, we can't pay women as much because we can't pay women as much because we can't pay women as much. It's just kind of a circular argument when there is no attention paid to all the different ways that men's sports are propped up by things like endorsements and TV time and the way, you know, games are scheduled, when the season is, when they're put on TV, things like that. The women's national team has defied a lot of that and said, well, you know what? We're still going to go out and we're going to even be more popular. And we're still not making as much money. We're generating more revenue and we're still not making as much money. So they really lifted the veil on a lot of that, on a lot of those arguments that have allowed those to almost be throwaway issues for some people. Like, well, it's just, that's just the way it is because men generate more revenue. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, it only took a week, mm-hmm. or not even a week, from the end of the World Cup for a bill to be introduced or announced mm-hmm. that would be introduced. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia said he was going to introduce a bill that mandates the men's and women's teams be paid again from what they get for playing for the national team. This isn't for paying mm-hmm. professionally for what they're being playing on the U.S. national team. And if that doesn't happen, the government then would not spend funds for the 2026 Men's World Cup, which is going to be played mostly in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it was less than a week from the end of the Women's World Cup that this came up.
Well, and I would argue when it comes to these national teams, women should be paid more. Why are we talking about equal pay? I mean, we can get into
based
the
on
weeds
results.
About, yeah, based on results, based on popularity, based on sale of merchandise. I mean, in all those metrics, in terms of the United States team's impact, the women are far outstretching the men.
Well, I think it's interesting to look specifically at some numbers here. The United States pays its women's soccer players 38% of what it pays its men's soccer players. And in the Women's 2019 World Cup, the champs earned a cumulative bonus of $4 million. Now, that bonus is going to be each player and coach on the team will get a share of that bonus, so they divvy up $4 million. I think there's 28 players on the roster and probably 5 to 8 coaches.
That's for the winner.
That's for the winner. Mm-hmm. Compare that to the total prize money awarded to the Men's World Cup, and that was $38 million. So the Women's Champion World Cup got $4 million. The Men's Champion World Cup in 2018 got $38 million. The overall prize money for women, all teams in this World Cup, was $30 million. The overall prize money for the Men's World Cup was $400 million. That's 13 times the amount. And so I think this is really important. One of the things that the women have filed a class action lawsuit against is not international soccer, because internationally men's soccer is
more popular.
More popular, yeah. And guys like Ronaldo and Messi are paid $100 million, and women are not paid internationally that way. But in the United States, it's undeniable that the women's national team is much more popular than the men's. In their lawsuit, which was filed, interestingly, on March 8th, 2019, which is International Women's Day, but their lawsuit is against the U.S. Soccer Federation. And it's a lawsuit that under the Equal Pay Act and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that they should be making the same amount of money as men for doing a similar job. I happen to agree with Marcia. They're not doing a similar job. They're doing a way better job and should be paid perhaps a lot more.
Well, some of the more, again, damning things that indicate the inequity are like the fact that the men's team had 20 chartered flights for play and women had 0 before this World Cup. The other ways that women are compensated for play on the national team, when their team is obviously more successful than the men's national team. Again, we could get into the weeds of how the professional ranks in the United States also display this inequity. I know the women's team the highest paid player, the best player, makes about $50,000 in the professional league, And the highest played men's player gets what? Multiple millions.
Right. I think maybe to go into on that just a little bit, how much would it change if professionally the women's league was on par with the men's league in the United States? And again, here are the numbers. Here are the numbers that we looked at today as far as average salary versus between MLS, which is the men's league in the United States and Canada, and the NWSL, which is the women's league. And it's quite stark. MLS average salary now is $345,000. It's more than doubled in 5 years, showing
the
popularity.
Average.
That's the average salary, showing the popularity of soccer. But the lowest paid player that I was able to find on their salary list makes $56,000 a year. The highest paid women's player in the NWSL makes $50,000,
yeah.
And the average salary, John, was $18,000, I think you
found? That's the minimum is $16,000.
A minimum, yeah.
The minimum is $16,000. And the person who's making that amount of money, that just below $50,000, is arguably the greatest women's soccer player on earth right now, Alex Morgan. And the fact that she makes below $50,000 and the greatest male soccer players in the world right now have contracts that make over $100 million is a stark difference.
So what would it take to close the gap, I guess, between professional leagues as far as visibility, exposure, popularity, and then pay? What would it take for a women's league to be on par with a men's league professionally in those ways? Not in quality of play, but in all those other aspects that sort of rise a league up mm-hmm. in the public's eyes.
I think Megan Rapinoe, in her speech that she gave at the ticker tape parade in New York City, was on point when she said to all the fans that were watching, buy tickets, come to our games. The men's soccer league, the MLS in the United States, has the third highest attendance of all professional sports in the United States right now, ranking behind the National Football League, of course, and Major League Baseball. But the average attendance of Major League Soccer men's games is higher than the NHL and even the NBA in average.
So it does show the popularity of soccer. I think it's safe to say it's the fourth most popular team sport in the United States. I think it is safely ahead of hockey at this point, and it's going to what sort of the other big three are, American football, basketball, and baseball, with a women's team that is so far better than the men's team here.
Well, I mean, it seems like, I mean, this sports in America is a capitalist enterprise. All the pieces are there for this to be a lucrative thing for people to buy in. And already people are jumping on the train. There's a whole, you know, kind of cadre of sports agents now that are focusing totally on women athletes, especially women soccer athletes and basketball. How can we begin to capitalize on you and get more endorsements, get your face out there? The women's 2019 World Cup soccer jersey is the most
highest selling Nike soccer jersey ever.
Of any, of men or women.
Yeah, of men
so
or women.
So let me finish real quick what I was going to say. So what I'm saying is, look at a Rapinoe, for instance. She is a marketing machine. She understands how to capitalize on what's happening for her right now. She's got all kinds of endorsements. She constantly uses her Twitter feed for saying stuff about different products, different companies. And she's got somebody helping her with that. I can tell you that right now. So if these women begin to get the kind of apparatus around them that men athletes, male athletes have, agents, financial advisors, endorsements, then the industry of women's sports in this country will begin to, you know, amplify the actual sport itself. It's never just about the sport mm-hmm. in America. It's always about the industry that is around it. That makes people want to have it on TV and have buy commercial time. That makes people want to stream it and, you know, buy different products. So all of those pieces are where the gap is. And that gap won't be filled until the kind of architecture of it all is filled in around it. And I think it's happening maybe it's on hyperspeed now after this after this World Cup.
Well, it's happening some. It's happening some with advertisers like Luna Bar. Donated over $31,000 to each woman on the championship team in an effort to make up the difference between the men's and women's bonuses that they earn. Adidas has said that from now on they will pay equal bonuses to men and women for winning World Cup. In Visa, which is perhaps the biggest U.S. sponsor, just signed a new 5-year deal with U.S. Soccer, and over 50% of the money that they've pledged is going to go to the women's team, not the men's. Mm-hmm. And so I think that those are significant steps. But again, I think Rapinoe had it best when she said, the best thing you can do is fill stadiums where women are playing soccer matches.
The MLS can grow in terms of popularity, and that's a league that's only 25 years old now, or not even that. It's been since the Men's World Cup was held in the U.S. in 1994. It would certainly seem that a women's league can grow equally. And again, if tickets were sold, if people were filling up these stadiums, and most of the stadiums that women's teams are playing on are in the 5,000 to 10,000 range, you might see more of them built, because MLS has certainly built a lot of soccer-specific stadiums in the last 10 to 15 years. And you don't talk about the architecture and apparatus of all that. That involves a lot of civic engagement. That's a lot of public money and taxpayer money that goes to these facilities and all that. But that seems to be really where one of the other gaps that would be filled in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And again, it's an ecosystem. It kind of feeds itself. And it's picking up steam. And some of it is people buying tickets, but also some of it is the kind of industry of sports saying, we want to get on this train. We're going to, you know, put y'all in the prime spots. We're going to do things to incentivize people to get on board this. It's, you know, men's sports has had a kind of affirmative action, you know, in terms of the way TV has treated it and the terms in terms of the way big sports industry has treated it. So equity doesn't just happen. There has to be an institutional apparatus underneath it for it to happen. You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.